Good morning, everybody, and happy 4th of July. My name is Jerry, and I'm an alcoholic. And I told my friend Bob earlier today that, you know, like I've heard other people do before I came up to speak, I went over to the restroom and I got in a stall and I got down on my knees and I took a big breath and prayed to God, and I got a message from God, and he said, "You're going to stink." And at least I think that's what the message was. So I want to thank you for being here. I want to thank the General Service Office for asking me to share some of my story today and some of my experiences under the topic Came to Believe. My sobriety date is May 15th, 1985. And under the category of Came to Believe, I want to try and cover four areas today. First is how I came to believe that there's a power greater than myself that's working in my life. Second, I want to talk about how I came to believe that it was really necessary for me to do the steps, and they really do apply to me. Third is I want to talk about how I came to believe that because of my involvement in Alcoholics Anonymous, I can get through anything because of AA and the people in AA. And then lastly, I want to talk about, if I have time, how I came to believe that I have a purpose in being here, which I didn't think I had. But in order to do that, I think one of the things I need to do is tell you kind of what I was like, you know, what I was really like, you know, not the actual version, not the one that I thought was true when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I joke about this, but believe me, this is how I really felt. I got here believing that I was the master of the universe. I knew all of the questions. I knew all of the answers. I was always right. I always wanted to be in charge. I always wanted to be first. And you know, and I thought I was being helpful to people, and by offering them my suggestions, even if they didn't want those suggestions or ask for those suggestions, which is why one of my coworkers had a nickname for me at work. And oftentimes I'd be offering some of my suggestions to either he or some of my other coworkers, and he'd say, "Thanks, JJ." And JJ stood for Jerry the Jerk. And I was quite offended by that because I didn't think I was being a jerk. I thought I was being helpful. If this type of behavior sounds familiar, that's because it's in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew that I drank more than other people. I did not view that as a problem. And I believed to my core that I could stop drinking anytime I wanted to. And therefore, I don't have to stop drinking to prove to you that I can stop drinking, because I know I can stop drinking anytime that I want to. You know, I was successful career-wise and that sort of stuff because, you know, I'm one of these people, like many, who as I was growing up just didn't feel like I belonged. I didn't feel that I was enough. I believed the great cosmic lie, as I am, I'm not enough. And so what I tried to do is build a world around me that the only person that saw it was me, trying to show you that I was so much better than anybody else. And that's what I was like as I was getting into AA. My last drink started on a Friday afternoon. I got home from work, and I started drinking, and I drank all Friday evening, passed out on my bed, woke up Saturday, drank on and off all day Saturday, all day on and off on Sunday. Monday, you know, normally I could get into work on Monday, and this Monday I couldn't get into work, so I called in sick. I was a supervisor, so I could get away with it. I drank all day. Passed out at night, woke up Tuesday, did the same thing Tuesday, did the same thing Wednesday. On Thursday morning, I got up and I went into the bathroom and I looked at myself. And I didn't recognize myself. You know, I hadn't shaved, showered, or changed my underwear since the previous Thursday. And I was a vision for you. And I realized for the very first time in my life, I can't stop drinking. And I was scared. I was really scared because, you know, this deep belief that I had that I could stop anytime that I wanted to, I found out that just wasn't accurate. And what happened for me is I went and I went back into my bedroom and I laid down on my bed and I said, and I said that prayer, God help me. And I meant it because I didn't know what else to do. So I said that prayer. And what happened for me is I heard this voice in my head that's all, call Tracy. It's like, huh? Said, call Tracy. And Tracy is someone that I had worked with. I hadn't seen her in a while, but I had worked with her and I thought, okay. So I called Tracy, and what I did is I just said to her, I can't stop drinking and I don't know what to do. And what happened for me is, unbeknownst to me, Tracy had 2 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what Tracy did and didn't do, she told me her story. She didn't tell me what I should do, any of that stuff. She shared her story, just like it's outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she asked me if I wanted to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that night. And no, I can't do that. Because, see, I didn't know anybody who was sober. I'd never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. But for the first time, I had hope. I had hope that something could be done about my drinking. Because I realized that was necessary. And what I did after that is I called my parents, I called some close friends, I called my boss, and I called the Employee Assistance Program. Made an appointment with EAP, and I got done with those phone calls, and I thought, crap, what have I just done? Because there was no going back, you know, at that time. And I don't know why I made those calls. I don't know why I made those calls. I don't know why I followed that voice and called Tracy. I don't know why she happened to be sober. I don't know why I made those calls. And I called my folks. I said, I want to spend the weekend with you, but I don't want to talk about alcohol, which was fine because they didn't either. And then coming home from them, you know, Sunday afternoon, I had to stop and buy some groceries. I didn't have a lot of food in the house. You can figure out what I had. And as I was walking into that grocery store, the same voice that told me to call Tracy said, go to the magazine rack. And it's like, I don't need a magazine. It's like, go to the magazine rack. So I go to the magazine rack, and I look at that, and right in the middle of the magazine rack, there's a Time magazine. And it's dated May 17th, 1985. And on the front of it, it has a highball glass with ice, water, and fun. And the cover story is about how people are drinking less and enjoying more. And it's like, oh. Start flipping through that. There's articles about Mothers Against Drunk Driving, about some of the new non-alcoholic beverages that they're coming out with, about Perrier, all of those stuff, things like that. And in the back of it, there's a picture of, there's an article about Alcoholics Anonymous because it was 30 years ago, so Alcoholics Anonymous was about to celebrate its 50th anniversary. And it had a picture of an AA room in there, you know, steps and traditions on the wall, the back of people's heads, all that sort of stuff. So what do? I buy the magazine. Meet with EAP on Monday. Long story on that, I'm not going to go into, but I told him that I'll go to a meeting with Tracy on Monday night. Tracy comes and picks me up, and I said, hey, before we go, take a look at this, you know, look at this magazine. And I show her the story about the AA meeting in the back of it. And she goes, yeah, that's where we're going. And I said, yeah, we're going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, no, we're going to that room. And it was. It was. And by the time I got to that meeting and they started talking about a power greater than yourself working in your life, I was absolutely convinced. Because I couldn't explain those things. You know, what are the chances of all that would happen? And by the way, the meeting was like a half a mile from my house. Never even seen the building before, practically. Well, that's because I was drinking. So I went to my first meeting, and I was blown away about people talking about themselves, etc. And the second day comes up, or on Tuesday, I said to Tracy, you know, you're going to take me to a meeting tonight. And she said, no. She said, you know where the meetings are. If you want Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to have to get out and look for it. You know where to go. I was a little bit offended by that because I was special. So I go to the Tuesday night meeting, and it's a big book study. And they're reading the chapter about working with others. And it says, what do you do if somebody approaches you and they say they have a problem with drinking? You tell them your story. And in my second meeting of AA, we're reading my story. We're reading about what I'm going through. This is exactly what happened to me. And I'm reading it, you know, and I'm hearing it at my second meeting. Wednesday, I go back to EAP, and I said, okay, want me to go to rehab? Whatever you want me to do, I'll do. And that's what happened. And so that was, you know, for me, that was huge. You know, I didn't understand all of these things that were happening in my life, but I knew that I'd better pay attention. And what I did is I went to rehab, started going to meetings of alcohol, more meetings of AA, et cetera. And so that's the first thing. In terms of, you know, when I went to those first AA meetings, you know, once the tears stopped, you know, and I heard the steps for the first time, I thought, you know, those steps are really great for the rest of you who have really messed up your lives. I'm really happy you have them. And but for me, you know, I drank too much, but my life was perfect. You know, and for me, my alcoholism, you know, I had the alcoholism on the side. Other than that, my life was perfect. You know, that goes back to my perception of me. And so, you know, and I thought the first three steps were great. Four-step, I didn't need to do that because I'd never done anything wrong or anything like that. And if you don't do four, you don't have to do five, and I didn't have any character defects, so I don't have to do six. So if I don't have to do six, then I don't have to do seven. And I never harmed anybody at all, ever, at all, so I don't have to do eight. If you don't do eight, you don't have to do nine. And I don't have to continue to take a personal inventory if I don't take one in the first place, so I don't have to do ten. Now, prayer and meditation was okay, and because of prayers, you know, got me into AA, where I met all of these people that I thought I was better than. And you know, but once I started getting active in AA, once I got my sponsor, once I started learning more about the steps, once I started reading AA literature, oh, what a concept, I realized that, you know what, these steps do apply to me. They really do apply to me. So that was my second came to believe. The third came to believe is, you know, that I can get through anything. You know, when I had about 10 years of sobriety, my brother died of a brain tumor. And, you know, if your parents, you know, imagine what it's like for parents to have a child that dies. And so several days prior to the funeral, I started saying a prayer. Because I'd learned how to do that by then through AA. And I started, and my brother had a wife and three kids. And I started praying, and I said, let me be a good brother-in-law. Let me be a good son. Let me be a good uncle. Let me be of service. And I prayed that about three times a day. And the morning of the funeral, I left my hotel room and went to my parents' hotel room. And I started saying that prayer again. I tried to say it. And I was blocked from doing it. And what I heard was that voice again saying to me, you will be a good son. You will be a good uncle. You will be a good brother. You will be of service. So I picked them up and I went to that funeral. And I remembered it's not all about me. And what I tried to do is do those things. And I could do that, and I did it comfortably without fear. Without fear. You know, how great is that? And one of the things I learned from that, one of the things I came to believe from that is I need to continue to pray. Even when I don't get the immediate results from prayer that I'm looking for, I have to use the discipline that I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous to continue to pray, even if I don't feel that I'm getting what I want. But when I really need it, my higher power is right there to get me through it. And that was one of my big learnings. I've gone through the death of both my mother and my father, to a certain extent helped them along the way, supported them, helped them let go, letting them know that it was okay. And I got through that with the support of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. So now I believe that I can get through absolutely anything without picking up a drink. I couldn't go a day without picking up a drink. And it's because I got in Alcoholics Anonymous, I jumped in the middle and stayed in the middle. Even though I wasn't sure it was for me, even though I didn't understand a lot of the things there, I had to be willing to learn that. And I've tried to remain willing, since that time. And then lastly, I came to believe that I had a purpose. You know, part of the reason that I drank is I'd go to bed every night and I'd think, if this is what life's about, so what? You know, I got the college degree. I got a good job. You know, I did all of those things. On the outside, things looked really good. If you asked me how I was fine. Being fine almost killed me. And I just didn't see any purpose in life. But again, because I've worked the steps, because I've sponsored guys, I've stayed involved. I'm involved in general service. I get to be friends with my area delegate who's here this morning. And I have changed without my permission, most of the time without my knowledge. My attitudes and my actions have changed. And it's only because that voice told me to call Tracy, and I followed everywhere that I was supposed to go. And I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's where I hope to stay. So thanks very much for being here this morning.
Thank you, Jerry. That was terrific. Our second speaker is Josephine M. from Texas.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Josephine, and I am an alcoholic. I'm truly grateful for the honor to be standing here before you. My sobriety date is December 6, 1990. My home group is the Graceland Group in Round Rock, Texas. So if you're ever there, come and see us. I was called, and they asked me to do this panel on Came to Believe. And the day that the lady called me, I had also agreed to have surgery. And so my first thought was, I can't do this. I'm having surgery. That's my excuse. You know, and I remember talking to my sponsor, and she said, you're making a decision for 3 months down the road, a day at a time, she said. So, you know, so I said yes, because I was told very early on, suit up and show up and follow directions. And so I did that. So as a result, I'm standing here, and, you know, God's done a real good job with me because I'm able to walk. You know, I didn't know if I was making it, but I told my therapist I had a goal. I told her I needed to go to this conference and I needed to be able to walk. And she said, okay, let's get to work. So I've been able to do that. Came to Believe for me is really one of the big parts of my recovery, because I came in this program and to stop drinking was, I thought, the miracle of all miracles. You know, I didn't think I needed anything beyond just not drinking. You know, so for a long time, all you all told me about was just don't pick up, just don't drink, and go to meetings. And that's what I did. And so for me, Came to Believe has been a process. You know, and the first part of that process was GOD, a group of drunks. You know, because I'd show up at a meeting, and you tell me what to do to get through the next 24 hours. And I followed that direction. You know, I was never a person who really followed directions. I was a rebel, you know, and Jerry gave you his nickname, and I thought, I don't want to tell him what my nickname was. My nickname was G.I. Joe, you know, and basically that meant I didn't need any help from anybody. You know, I'd do it myself. But by the time I got here, I was spiritually, mentally, emotionally bankrupt, you know, and one of the things that I realized when they asked me to do this topic was, that was one of the things that I had a problem with when I got here, was that I had believed in a lot of things before I got here, and it all failed. people, places, situations. They all let me down. And when I got here and I was sober a little while and I saw that second and third step, I got really afraid. I was like, okay, this might be my parting. I might not be able to stay here after that. Because at 17 years old, I walked away from the church that I grew up in. And I thought, you know, that's not for me. You know, so it's like, I don't know if this is going to work. You know, but I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. And you told me to do a day at a time. And so for a day at a time, you know, I was like, okay, I'm just going to sit in the rooms. You know, I was talking to my sponsor. She said, when you go to meetings and they say, what step do you want to work? Speak up and ask for the second or the third step. And I did that. And I started listening to what you all were sharing because I came in believing something that I didn't want to bring back into my life. You know, so I had to sit at tables and I was listening to you all and I started to realize that you were talking about something that I had no understanding of. You were talking about a power of grace and mercy, you know, a power that kept you sober, that guided you, that was helping you to grow up in a good way and be a good person, you know. And I became intrigued, and what I understand now is I became a little open-minded, just a little bit, you know. And I kept coming, I kept sitting, I kept watching, and I just kept following that good old direction. It was an old-timer who, he had been at a lot of tables with me, and he knew that I was having a problem with that thing called God. And he said, Josephine, he said, when you go to meetings, he said, just think of good orderly direction. He said, can you follow good orderly direction? I was like, yeah, I could do that. He said, that's G-O-D. He said, so whenever someone says the word God, you just think to yourself, good orderly direction, and you listen to what they say. See, what I realized was whenever you said God, I never knew what you said behind that because God was the end of what I ever knew. You know, so when I was at a table and you said God, I good orderly direction, and I listened to whatever else you said, you know. And so that started to work for me because I started to hear what you were actually talking about. You know, you were talking about that guidance that you were getting from the power that was in your life. And I knew I needed that, but I didn't know how to let it in. And I remember going to this meeting and this lady said, I prayed to my grandmother's God and I got drunk. I prayed to my mother's God and I got drunk. She said, and I was fortunate enough to make it back in these rooms. And I, at that point, I got a God of my own understanding. And it was amazing. This light bulb went on and it was like, of my own understanding? And that's the first day that I ever went home and I prayed. Since then, my relationship in with the higher power in my life has changed. You know, first it was just, God, please just don't help me drink. You know, I just don't want to drink. You know, then it got to a point where not only do I just not want to drink, can you help me learn how to live? You know, they told me I came in here for my drinking. I stay for my thinking. And it's, I want to be a better person. I always wanted to be a better person, but I just didn't know how to get there. You know, so they told me to follow, you know, watch what you were doing and follow the winners. And I did that. You know, I identified people that I thought was doing what I wanted to do, and I would ask them, you know, I would watch them. I was a good watcher. You know, for a long time, I watched people, and they never knew. You know, there was this one lady, I was going to a conference, and she was, to me, intimidating because she was what I always wanted to be. You know, she was walking and talking the program. And I was like, wow. And I remember I would go to this conference, and for about 2-3 years, I would never speak to her. I was just too intimidated. And I remember this one year, I was sitting down, and somehow she just seemed to be standing next to me. And she just started talking to me. And I was like, wow, she's talking to me. Because I came in here also with low self-esteem. So I didn't believe that I was worthy of a lot of people's attention. You know, but what I also realize is that when I just suit up and show up, a lot of times I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be. I remember I wanted to find the group of people who could just really give me the short track on how to get this thing called the second and third step. And I remember there was this a spiritual conference. And I was like, okay, if I go to the spiritual conference, I'm going to find these spiritual gurus, and they're going to tell me how to get this thing down. And so I didn't have a car, but this lady agreed to drive me, and she didn't want to go, but she would drop me off at the conference. And it was about 50 miles from home. So she drove 50 miles to get me there and 50 miles to come back and get me. So I surrendered my pride, and I took the offer, and I went to this conference. It was a retreat, and it was outside. And when I got there, what I realized was all the people that was registering were the same people I saw at meetings. So I was like, I was getting really frustrated because there's no new information because these are the same old people. So I got really frustrated, and I saw this basketball court, and I played basketball when I was in high school. And there was a ball sitting in the middle of the court. And I went down there, and I played full court basketball by myself. I ran up and down the court until I was just beaten. And what I realized was when I got thoroughly beaten and I sat down, what I realized was that's the best it's ever going to be. All I can do is put myself in the midst of seekers, you know, and that's what you all are for me. You're a group of seekers trying to do better a day at a time. And that's what I found myself there, you know, standing there. But I had to become beaten. I'm an alcoholic, you know. They say when I become beaten, I become willing. You know, so I became open to what was going on that weekend, and I sat there, and I was able to hear what they had to say. You know, and so it's been a process like that for me. You know, I come here, and I listen to what you all say, and I go, yeah, yeah. I remember going to a conference, and this woman said, everything I hand over to God is unrecognizable. She said, it's shredded to pieces. And she said, most of the things I turn over, I claim to love. And I was like, ooh, I understand that. You know, and she said one of her goals became working real hard on trying to turn things over to God while it was still recognizable. And I was like, that appealed to me. You know, so I went back into my own life, and I really tried to start turning things over, which meant I wasn't trying to work it and tweak it until I just couldn't recognize it, and then I'll turn it over to God. So I just started trying to turn it over to God first. So for me, that was part of the process. I remember I was 2 years sober, and my mother was in the hospital. She had an aortic aneurysm, and I stayed in Detroit, and she was in the hospital at University of Michigan, which was in Ann Arbor. So that's about a half-hour ride. And at the time, I was dealing with some wreckage of my past, and so I had this little putt-putt. It blew smoke, white smoke out the back. You had to put water and oil in it every day, you know. And my husband told me, he said, you know, I'm really not comfortable with you driving that car on the highway that far. But I had done what you all told me to do. You know, I was responsible, becoming responsible at that point. And I had prayed to God. I was like, God, let this car help me to do what I needed to do. And my husband wasn't in the program, and he wasn't doing a God or higher power. And he looked at me like, I don't know about that. You know, but the day my mother passed, my brothers and sisters, there were three of them, and they all had brand new cars. But for whatever reason, the day my mother passed, the day we got that call to come to the hospital, none of their cars were working. So all of them piled into this little putt-putt. And we're up the highway, and we go to the University of Michigan. We did what we needed to do. My mother passed, and we're on our way back. And we're on this 96 freeway. And we come up at 96, and it turns into a street. And so when it came up off the freeway and it turned into a street, it stopped at the stoplight, and the car said, put, put, and it stopped. That car never ran again. You know, and my husband looked over at me, and he was like, could you be careful what you pray for? And I was like, yeah, I think so. You know, and that was truly one of those big moments, because there have been many little moments where God had already been working in my life. But that was clearly one of those big moments where it was real clear to me that God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. When I came in here, I remember sitting down talking with another member, and we were both kind of new. And she said, well, you know, what do you believe? And I said, you know, when I came in here, what I believed was If 20 of us jumped in the pool and we all didn't know how to swim, I would be the last one that God would come to get. So I needed to take care of myself. By this time, the conversation evolved to 20 of us jump in the pool. All I know is God is coming for me first. I don't know what's happening to you. You know, I'd love to believe he's coming for all of you, but that's not my business. My business is working on my relationship, and I know he's coming for me first. You know, so that's part of how my relationship in coming to believe has evolved. Over the years, I've had to turn some things over. But what I've come to believe is that as I turn things over, God says, give them to me. And then he says, now go do my business. You know, and a lot of times for me, that's been service work. You know, again, 2 years sober, I had to turn my son over, my oldest son over to God, because he was in a place in his life where I couldn't help him. And I knew that. So I did the hard thing, and I let him go, and I turned him over, and I didn't know what was going to happen. You know, and God told me, just go start working with you all. Go do some service work. Because the day I let him go from my house, I had to call another member. And I asked her, I said, would you talk to me until he leaves? Because if I get off this phone before he leaves, I'll say, never mind, and I'll let him stay. And I let him go, and he went out in the world, and he did what he needed to do. And 20 years later, last December, my son called me. I said, Mom, I'm graduating. I said, graduating from what? And he's today an ordained minister. You know, God did for me what I could not do for myself. You know, God took care of that boy. You know, I remember he came to my house, and he was driving a Buick, and I looked outside, and there were bullet holes all up and down the side of the car. You know, he said, but I'm okay, Mom. And what he got out of that is, if you're going to be out there in the world, drive a Buick. You know, I went to see him when he got ordained, when he graduated, and in him telling his story, he said, it never dawned on me that God was taking care of me. You know, but one of the things he said to people, he said, if you don't believe in prayer, talk to that little lady right there, because I'm standing here as a result of her prayers. Because, you know, I knew I had to let him go, and all I could do was pray for him. You know, so, you know, if God could take care of that boy in such a fantastic manner, you know, I've come to believe that if he can take care of the big things, he can take care of the little things. And all I have to do is do the work that God puts in front of me. And it was a little difficult for me to understand that sometimes that work is just greeting one of you or giving one of you a ride or just suiting up, showing up and telling my story and letting people know that recovery is still going on. Because when I came in the rooms, like Jerry said, I didn't know anybody who had gotten sober. People that I knew either died out. No, they died out. If they ever drank at all, that's how they got out. They either didn't have a problem or they died out. So, you know, I was one of the first people, not only in my family, but maybe even in my neighborhood, that attempted sobriety. You know, so it is amazing to me that God can do what he has done with this thing called Josephine. Because sometimes when I am asked to do something, I still remember that wet behind the ears girl that walked in these rooms. And, you know, you all greet me as the woman I am today. But most days, I still remember, you know, where I was when I walked in these rooms some years ago. You know, so I am truly grateful and honored to be here. And this has been a great experience. Thank you.
Thank you, Josephine. That was terrific. Our final speaker today is George D. from New York.
Hi, my name's George, and I'm an alcoholic. And I turned, I'm a little tired. This is my 11th international convention. And I keep running into people from the past that I just love seeing the fair maid of Perth down here. That's Perth, Australia. And just people from all over the world in the past. And so I am pretty tired. And, you know, I turned 88 in May. So I've got to be more careful. I've got to remember I'm not 87 anymore. But, you know, about 20, I think 1985, my partner talked to one of these things, and he said, you know, there's a lot of people here in this convention, maybe in this room, for whom this is the greatest thing that ever happened. It's a wonderful spiritual experience, and just raving. And there's other people who are very uncomfortable, who feel totally lost in the crowd, who would just love to go home as soon as possible. And there are other people, that maybe most of us. This is great, but it's not all there is. You know, it's okay, it's fine, but it's no big deal and no terrible deal. So it does not matter in which group one belongs. It's okay either way. If you can think it's the greatest thing you ever happened to you, or you can think it's the worst thing that you've been involved in your sobriety, or you can think it's just okay. It's all right. And I hope that might be of some comfort to some of you. I've had pretty unusual access to the archives, and Bill, towards the end of his life, became concerned that we would try to turn Alcoholics Anonymous into some kind of a religion. And he kept stressing that we are not trying to compete with any religion at all. That even as far back as 1964, I found a letter that I hope will set the tone of whatever I'm trying to say, and I'm not sure what I'm trying to say this morning. But it was in response to a guy who was apparently disappointed that his sponsees and other people that he was trying to work with had not seen fit to thoroughly follow his path. So Bill says, "Dear Bob, our way, both as members and as groups, are practicing the steps, appears to vary from time to time." I love that. I think it's certainly been my experience. "Many of us lack Theranos, which most evidently you do not. And I'm very glad that you have had such good results with the approach you made. I have only one suggestion. This would be to avoid trying to force anyone into your particular approach. Your example of good results is apt to be much more effective with others than your insistence that they conform to your particular interpretation. Most of us alcoholics are apt to be all or nothing people. We go to extremes. Either we want perfection by Thursday next, or else we want only the barest bit of AA that will keep us sober. Experience seems to show that we can go broke on spiritual pride or on unreasonable rebellion, or just plain apathy. A plain, everyday desire to make some progress is usually the best and safest bit." And I love this. "However, don't take what I say as the gospel. You and everybody have the right to practice AA as you wish. This is spiritual freedom." I had my last drink on October 4th, 1961. That's 53 years plus ago. But if we accept the premise that the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking, I've been an AA member as of this weekend for 60 years. I never left AA. I didn't always show up sober, but I most certainly had a desire to stop drinking. I just didn't. Took me a while to kind of get the hang of it. I was an alcoholic right out of the gate. I won't go into my drunk log. I mean, first drink, first drunk, first blackout, first lots of other things. At 15 and never slowed down, really. And looking back at that kid and young man, I have some admiration for him. They say we don't have willpower. I mean, it took an enormous amount of willpower on my part to get as far as I did, considering that I was eating the sheriff's oatmeal every other week and just in constant trouble. But I had a program, which was to become a rich and powerful alcoholic. Because I'd grown up surrounded by alcoholism and worked as an office boy in a powerful advertising agency. And so I knew what alcoholism was. And I had, with my keen, observant mind, I had noticed that alcoholics who were rich and powerful got through life much better than alcoholics who were broke and powerless. So that was my program, because I really knew I was an alcoholic right out of the gun. I knew that it was always going to be a problem for me, but the idea of not drinking never occurred to me. I never knew anybody who did not drink. But somewhere along in my 20s, I was 12-stepped by a friend of mine who was drunk when he 12-stepped me. You know, that's not the best way to carry the message. But he planted a seed, and I've done some 12-stepping when I was drunk. You kind of get them that's numb enough, and they'll in the bar, and they'll listen to you talking about Sister Ignatia and Dr. Bob and the whole thing, you know. But then at 28, I had a transforming experience, moment of truth, spiritual awakening, call it whatever you want, in Lincoln Heights, which sounds like a very fancy treatment facility, but it wasn't. It was the Los Angeles County Jail. And I was in the drunk tank. And I realized my program was a waste of time, that my life, you know, I had really worked pretty hard and hadn't done too badly, but my whole program of what I would do and get out of life was going to go down the tubes on any given drunk. It was just a matter of time, and the time was growing short. And I also realized for the first time that my alcoholism didn't just affect me. It affected anybody who had any contact with me. The closer you were to me, the more danger you were. And it's like throwing a stone into a pond, but the ripples go way out, keep spreading out. If you're right next to the stone, you're going to in real trouble, but the ripples go out. And with that, I looked up Alcoholics Anonymous. All I remembered about the 12-step call in the bar was that he talked about the big book. And so I called up the Los Angeles Central office and went down there and bought the big book. And my car was still in jail. I'd hit a police car. And so I got on the Wilshire bus and started reading the big book, got off in Santa Monica, the end of the line, sat on the bench above on the Palisades above the ocean, and kept on reading. By the time I got back into town, I was well into the stories, and that was my epiphany right there. I knew there was no going back, that I lost my innocence, that there was hope, but there was no going back to the idea that somehow, some way, I could live with my alcoholism. That was the first step. And I went to a young people's group, and, you know, I hear a lot about back to basics. I think back to basics is wonderful, but who the hell's basics do you want to go back to? There were all kinds of basics. In that young people's group, we understood that the steps don't say, you will admit that you are an alcoholic, you will do this, you will do that. It was what we did, not what you should do. And we understood that. And we were able to talk about it endlessly, argue about it endlessly, and make 12 steps endlessly. We were obsessed with carrying the message. There were no treatment facilities or anything like that, and AA was beginning to explode, and we were a young people's group. We got tons and tons of 12-step calls from the central office, and we were all kind of crazy, and our sober lives were crazier than a lot of your drunk logs. But I think what kept us out of more trouble than we got into, as it was our obsession with carrying the message. My sponsor was a compulsive 12-stepper, and he didn't have a car. I had the car. But he felt it was a waste of time to go to a meeting unless you had two or three people in various states of detoxification in the car with you. And I kept the bottle in the car, and I'd pass the bottle back. Joe was physician-in-chief, and I was sort of the resident physician or intern. And we'd practice medicine three or four nights a week. And, you know, it is a miracle we didn't kill anybody. We did have convulsions. And that, you know, I look back at those years fondly, but things are better now, I mean, for alcoholics. When I came into AA in those early years, I was definitely a very comfortable doctrinary Christian. In fact, I became active in a Christian church in my early sobriety. But that didn't seem to work out too well in my mind. You know, I love the chapter to the agnostic, although, as many people have pointed out, it's sort of bait and switch. You know, it says you come in, you're agnostic, you don't believe, that's fine, you're welcome, you'll do great, you can get sober, and blah, 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 blah. And then at the end, and of course, once you get there, then you will believe. Well, that's wonderful. But that reflects the experience of people with three and a half years of sobriety, Bill with four, perhaps. And our experience has proved something different, that people can come in agnostic or atheist and stay sober and live very spiritual lives, helping a lot of people and have happy, long, happy, sober, spiritual lives without coming to believe. With me, it's a different story, which maybe I'll talk about before she gives me the tug. But my spiritual journey was different. It just went on, and it's still continuing, I hope, that my concept of some higher power has evolved. It's a journey. Once I reach the destination, you can call Campbell's, the local funeral parlor, and have them come pick up the remains, because that'll be the end of it. A guy named Chuck C. told me that once long time ago. Once we get all the answers, it's time to check out. And I believe me, I do not have all the answers. But at the end of my drinking, you know, I thought it appeared that I had destroyed everything that I thought I should be, every potential for a decent career, every relationship that was important to me. I thought everything was left. And I did have a spiritual experience. I totally surrendered. I had surrendered to the idea that my life was powerless if I was drinking. But I thought with sobriety, life would become manageable. And my initial relationship with a higher power was sort of a business situation. We had a contract. I would be a good guy. I would work my ass off at the job. I would be a good family member. I would make all these damn 12-step calls and do all these good things. And God's side of the contract was to give me a few things: promotions, a new romance, a better house, a bigger car, I did this twice with almost 2 years of sobriety. I was keeping my end of the bargain, but God was breaking his end. This is the God of my understanding then, and that God had to go. What it really amounts to is putting conditions on sobriety. And I could not stay sober if I have any conditions on sobriety. I've got to stay sober for sobriety's sake. And that alone. And the end of the drinking, I just decided, even though everything was seemed to be lost, I was still alive. And I would try to stay alive. And the one thing I believed to my core was that my only hope of staying alive was in Alcoholics Anonymous. I believed every cell in my body in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't recall thinking terribly about any concept of God at the time, other than my true belief that AA was my only hope. And for the first time, speakers talked about surrender. I really surrendered. I realized that I cannot, that my life was always going to be unmanageable, that life itself is unmanageable. We're human beings. I can't manage my life or anybody else's without some help from outside of myself. I don't care what you call that power. That doesn't make much difference to me. It's a power that's present in each of us and greater than all of us. And that's about where I am now, and it's just about that simple. I do want to read something from a pamphlet that's 45 years old. We talk about back to basics from a dear, dear friend of mine, a big influence on my life and my sobriety, in which he says, the house, and he means the spiritual home, of course, that AA helps a man build for himself is different for each occupant, because each occupant is his own architect. For many, AA is a kind of going home, a return, like the prodigal sons, to the house and the faith of his fathers. To others, it is a never-ending journey into lands that they did not dream existed. It does not matter into which group one falls. What is really important is that AA has more than demonstrated that the house it builds can accommodate the rebel as well as the conformist, the radical as well as the conservative, the agnostic as well as the believer. The absence of formalized dogma, the lack of rules and commandments, the non-specific nature of its definitions contribute to this incredible and happy end. And I believe every word of that. And I think it's true of AA. It always has been. And I really trust that it will continue to be true. My own spiritual journey is more as Alan describes, a journey, a never-ending journey into lands that I did not dream exist spiritually. If I were going to sum up where I am at 88 and all this sobriety and 11 international conventions, it would be that I am overwhelmed with a profound and limitless sense of gratitude. Gratitude to AA, of course, but it goes bigger than that. It's a huge gratitude. Gratitude for the fact that I have lived, that there has been somebody named George Dorsey. Gratitude for the fact that I've lived so long. Gratitude, we can have gratitude for good things and not so much gratitude for bad things that happen in our human lives. But this gratitude I'm talking about is broader. I've got to be I'm grateful for everything that has been, that is a part of life and a part of me. And that gratitude has something to do with, it has totally to do with a power that's greater than myself. I don't know if I made any sense at all. Thank you. I love you all. Bye-bye.
Thank you. That was just wonderful, demonstrating to me once again that AA really is a broad
highway, and there's room for every nut, no matter what your belief is in this great program. So let's give our speakers another hand.